Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and two times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small cap. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul, and what an exciting week we've got to run through.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're certainly like the weather. The markets have been red hot this week with M&A activity. And let's go straight into some updates. We've got Ben Sharman at the top of the slate asking about Advanced Medical Solutions that both you and I called perfectly over the last month. So take us through it. What's been happening?
Oh, it's been marvellous, hasn't it? Don't you just love it when a plan works as you hope? So, yeah, and I think quite a lot of the listeners were persuaded by our analysis to follow suit, actually. Quite on my Substack, a lot of the readers, you know, have given a hat tip and a thank you to you, Paul, primarily, for coming up with this one. Yeah, it did exactly what we thought. We got the bid, £2.85. It opened at about £2.78. I waited 5 or 10 minutes to see where it would settle and then sold them. So for me, that was job done. Happy to move on. You know, I'm not going, because I think they're talking about it not completing till the end of the year. Plus, you've got deal risk that it may not actually go through. Offsetting that, you've got the potential that there could be a higher competing offer. But for my purposes, it's done the job. I've banked it and moved on, because there's so much low hanging fruit. We can recycle that money into something else, can't we? That's the thing.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I mean, just as a bit of background for everyone, it's HB Fuller trade buyer out in the States who have put the 285p per share on it, which equates to 21 times PE and 13 times EBITDA. So it's a sort of like a full stroke fair offer. Clearly, they want it. Now, what's quite interesting is that because the shares are currently trading at such a small discount to the offer, so 178p compared to 185, and you've got that time value of money, as you rightly point out, which is at least 6 months, and it sounds as though it could be slightly longer than that, then the question that I have is who's buying the shares? Because they took out Hargreave Hale yesterday, and there's been Rathbone selling. A lot of institutions have done what we've done, basically banked the profits and moved on and thought about sort of recycling. So somebody's been buying it. Now, it probably is HB Fuller, because their irrevocables were only about 0.4% at the time of the document was released. They're building that up to try and make sure nobody else can sort of like try and nip in at the end. But it'd be interesting. Nobody's been disclosed yet. So let's see who actually has been mopping all these shares up. I mean, as I say, that'd be my only take. But yeah, you and I are absolutely delighted. I mean, it's an advanced wound care type business. It's a bit of a sort of trophy asset. And then people need to, you know, have a look at other sort of there's lots of other good life science companies out there that are on reasonably cheap valuations. I mean, something which looks very similar to Advanced Medical Solutions is Convatec, bigger business, but it's been regularly talked about. I know another one which I wouldn't go towards, but it looks like a bit of a value chap, but it's Smith & Nephew, because they've got a big wound care business as well. So clearly these are sort of like assets that are well respected around the world. But I think you and I were quite, and a lot of the investors were delighted. So what have you been reading? Have you decided where you're putting your money at all, Paul?
Yeah, well, a lot of it actually was just getting me off margin call.
Why do things not change?
They never change. No, everyone says that. They said, But anyway, I did manage to scrape a bit of cash together to buy I can't find my notes now, but I have to remember it. I've gone back into the house builders, but I've decided I missed the, but it looks like I sold right at the bottom, which I was worried about at the time. But there's been a sudden and quite significant improvement in sentiment for the house builders recently. I've just been talking to Lord Lee about that actually on a podcast. And so I missed my favorite one, Barrett Redrow. So I've gone for MJ Gleeson. So yep. I'm back in MJ Gleeson. And I've topped up my card factory. I've up to a full, that was slightly short of a full position size. I think that is good after good results from Moonpig, and they've got obviously Funky Pigeon, the smaller competitor. And I've topped up a couple of other things, but yeah, the main one was Gleeson. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I've still got my Gleeson share, so we joined the crew again there, because I know we're we both think that. I mean, if when Burnham comes in, I mean, he's clearly got to get the economy moving, and you would hope they would be more, or realise the best way of doing that is through the house builders, and so let's wait and see. So, but yeah. But even having said that, because now the oil price has come down so much and it's around pre-war levels before the Middle East.
Yes.
Crisis, that means yields on gilts have come down. Mortgages now are getting more competitive. You've seen Nationwide already reducing their actual interest rates on their mortgages. So that's going to hopefully stimulate things. And so it just needs a bit of sentiment and a bit of feel good factor. So who knows?
Yeah, I agree. And I was also, I asked AI this morning to tell me about what the knock on effect of the lower oil price will be. And it said basically that over the next few months, you should start to see quite sharp reductions in anything petrochemical related, which we know, of course, is polymers, it's plastics, all these things. It reckons in a few months, those inflationary pressures will be coming right off again, which so Andy Burnham looks like, I know we don't do the party politics here, but it looks like he's going to be one of the luckiest incoming prime ministers going, where he'll be able to start crowing about the economy improving before he's done a damn thing.
Well, it'd be not, yeah, it can't do any worse than the ones we've had before, that's for sure. Both Conservatives and Labour have been disaster over the last four.
I know. I think they're all, sorry, yeah, nearly score there, but you get the gist.
Anyway, yeah, so what I've done with my money, I've added to my positions in, Pinewood Technology, Crane, where I added to, bought a bit of Fintel as well. And I've also bought a sliver of, but there's no liquidity in Traxys, you know, basically the rail tech software business, which I do like at these levels, but there's no sellers at the market. So this is like, I'll have to wait. If I get a chance, I'll add to it over the next few weeks if I get a chance.
Yeah, and I think you can only generally trade in clips of 2,500 shares in Traxys, which for a man of your means, Paul, isn't even a 4 or 5 decimal point.
No, it was absolutely blipping useless. And then, anyway, let's go. We've got another one in life sciences that we've had at M&A. We've got Spire Healthcare had an extension to its put up or shut up. This has got an indicative offer from its largest shareholder, Tosca Fund, which I think own 18%, just over, of the business. The biggest shareholders is Mediclinic, which is a healthcare business, hospital operator in South Africa, but has operations in the Middle East. Anyway, it's been put up for sale. Tosca Fund, well, basically the company put out an announcement this week saying they still need more time to complete due diligence. I've owned it. I actually sold my shares on the back of it. And the reason why I did was that, you know, I thought the previous put up or shut up for Spire Healthcare had been largely related to them sorting out their funding, you know, their facilities, etc. Because let's be clear about it, they've been an 18% shareholder of Spire for the last 5, 10, 15 ages. Mm-hmm. Okay. They know this business like the back of the hand. It just looked a pretty lame excuse to say you needed more due diligence, because they know this. If you're an 18% shareholder, I know they haven't got a board, but they'll be all over this business. They'll, you know, in terms of, they won't get access. But anyway, they say they needed more. They need another 2 weeks. It was a fairly short put up, you know, extension, no doubt about it, which is obviously, you know, positive. But then the other bit of news which came out this week was that PHP, the healthcare operator that that recently bought Assura, that does all the, basically owns all the the doctor's surgeries and the sort of healthcare centers. On the Assura portfolio that they acquired, they also own about £700 million worth of hospitals. Mm. And they're looking to they've said in strategic review, they're looking to offload that.
And they're advanced JV.
And they're advanced discussions with an investor. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm obviously a sort of like a skeptic, and I put one and one and sometimes get five or ten or the wrong answer, okay? But I'm a bit concerned that actually that other investor on advanced discussions, it's sort of like very coincidental. It's exactly the same timing as Tosca Fund have asked for some extra time in terms of sorting it out. I think there's a danger. Yeah, it's less than 50%, but I think there's a probability. I think there's a danger that we actually have got a deal chain here that Tosca need to basically be part of that joint venture with PHP to basically fund the Spire acquisition of the £2.50. And the reason why I say that is because they'll create this if it was the case, they'd create this joint venture. Spire would put its properties into the joint venture. Assura, or effectively a PHP, would put its properties. Both companies would sell that at, say, net asset value. They'd fund it with a bunch of debt. The debt would then help pay for Spire, the operating company that Tosca then owns. And that would explain also that it would then be a very, very nice return for Tosca Fund, and also explains why Harwood have already said that they've indicated they're going to roll their equity into that new vehicle, the operating company, because that operating company is then going to be stuffed full of cash, which as soon as it becomes effectively private, they'll just dividend it out and they'll be left with an operating company, probably still with more cash and just upside, and they'll have more than 250. So I could be just read, as I say, I'm sure the balance of probabilities is that it's basically, I've got the wrong answer. That's not right. But I think there's a more than zero probability risk that there's a deal chain associated with Tosca's funding. And if there is a deal chain, it means more things can go wrong because it gives some of the approval to PHP. So anyway, to cut a long story short, that was the only reason I sold. I just thought there is a chance here that actually, if it's like a house chain, that something breaks down and
something can fall apart. Yeah, yeah. No, that all makes sense, Paul. I mean, that's really beyond the level of analysis I do on these things. I mean, all I would say really for Spire, the stock market at £2.19, when you're potentially only days or a week or two away from a bid at £2.50, is giving quite a reasonable chance of that deal falling through, isn't it? And we've seen from the chart that you had up a moment ago that when the last deal fell through, I mean, it gapped down as low as about £1.45, didn't it? So, I mean, what do you do at that level? Looking at the chart, it dips sharply down like that three times now, and they've both been great buying opportunities, great buying opportunities. So it could be one to you just wait and see what happens and plunge in again and go for a triple on it.
I think you're a bit modest, actually, Paul. You're pretty good on this M&A game because you called out this one before. And let's go to Ramsden's, basically the UK. One of the UK pawnbrokers. It's mainly it sells jewellery and does gold trading, and also Forex, and Paul Burrick is also one part of its services in its shops in the Northeast and the Midlands area. Anyway, you've called this one right because it's got taken over. It's got an offer at £6 per share by First Cash, who also already own the largest pawnbroker, H&T. They bought, I think it was about 18 months ago.
Oh, is this the same outfit, is it?
Yeah, First Cash bought H&T last year in May 2025. So anyway, you called it out. What's your view on this
one? To be fair, I didn't predict a takeover on Ramsden's. We've been quite keen on it, but we have pointed out a number of times that the The earnings growth is very much highly linked to the soaring gold price. And with gold now having retreated quite a lot from the highs, we actually went a bit more neutral on this on valuation grounds. Obviously, we didn't factor in the potential for a takeover bid, because that's just a complete unknown, isn't it? When they do happen, it's lovely. I mean, I think given the fact that this is a very cyclical business related to gold, if it were me and I held this share, I'd be delighted with the bid. You know, and I'd be accepting it. Yes, it's optically cheap on still on a fairly low PE. But as I say, we know how this sector works. We followed it for 30 odd years, you know, went back to the days of Albemarle and Bond, for example. And, you know, they are very cyclical businesses. But people forget that when you have a long bull run in gold, don't they? So I think this is a more than satisfactory outcome for people. So very well done to people who held on. Lovely to see you making a bob or two. And of course, all this money gets reinvested, doesn't it? So sentiment is improving in UK smaller and mid caps, I think. And every bid that we're having, one a day at the moment, these bids, sooner or later, the penny drops. Bloody hell, you know, this is a cheap market. They're being picked off one by one at premiums. People should be all over the UK market. And I think that is starting to happen, actually.
Mm. If you own the shares, which neither of us do, they trade at 590. They've already gone ex-dividend, I think. So on a like-for-like, it compares to £6, which is what their offer is. Yeah. And they've obviously got to go through the CMA review. So that you're not going to get your money for minimum 3 months, if not 6 months. What would you do if you own the shares now?
Oh, if it was me, definitely bank the profit, just like we did with AMS, because it's the opportunities that you can recycle that money into something that we could find another AMS and make a 30% gain in 4 or 5 weeks. You know, I think we're in a really exciting bull market now, actually. It's not coming through in all the stocks, because it depends on a stock by stock basis which ones have got fund managers redemption related selling. And but you can clearly see the ones that have, can't you? They just sell off after good news and relentlessly. So but sooner or later that selling will run out. So I just think that we're absolutely awash with opportunities. So for me, it's all about recycling it and going for the next thing, definitely.
I would do exactly the same as you if I held them. And the reason when I would be just a bit nervous of this CMA now, CMA review. And the reason why I say that, which the market isn't, the market is absolutely saying it's not a problem. Now, the geographical footprint of H&T is more southeastern, southern UK. Okay. And the more of Ramsden's is more, you know, north, etc., and the Midlands. So they don't have that much overlap in terms of their store print. And they don't actually have that much in terms of market share overlap in pawnbroking, because H&T is the big pawnbroker. I think it's about sort of 20, 30% of the market. And I think Ramsden's is less than 5%. So it's unlikely to get caught in this, in that. But the reason why I would be slightly sort of cautious on it, because if I was in the CMA, I would basically say, actually, they're putting all these stores together. There's not much overlap, but they're going to have total national coverage. Now, what will be the market share 12 months, 18 months in advance? Sorry, afterwards, after the deal can close, because they're just going to cross-sell, aren't they? I mean, that's why First, you know, Cash is buying them. He's basically, they're going to take all of the Ramsdens and shove each cross-seller in each one. So they're going to get a bigger market share of pawnbroking in the UK. And I would, if I was an independent pawnbroker up in the north, I would be banging the door down of the CMA saying, you can't allow this to happen. They've got 30% or more of the market in the south. You suddenly give them a store in the north, they're going to cross-sell and subsidize it, and we're going to get absolutely annihilated. So I'd be interested to know how the CMA looks at this. Is it a predictive animal, or is it in terms of where it's likely to go to, or is it actually a straight bullet point? Because if it's the former, I would definitely sell in the market, just because if I was in the CMA, I'd have a lot of people saying, you've got to look at this one really closely.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know much about the CMA, but I do remember with the tiles operators, they looked into that, and with the vets, and there was a third one, wasn't there, a CMA inquiry? And they did seem to do it on a town by town basis, which really surprised me. But in which case, that could mean that they might get off lightly because of what you said about them having a different geographical footprint. So, but who knows? But personally, I wouldn't want to be, I don't invest in situations like that where you have that sort of deal risk. I think if you've made the big jump of money, for me, just bank it and move on. But other people specialize in deal arbitrage, don't they? So, you know, each their own, I think. There's no one size fits all rule, but
Yeah, well, we're still on the M&A theme, as you say. There's nearly one a day. In fact, it's mainly, there's a recurrent theme. It's the sort of like the US barbarians at the gate, because so we've got HB Fuller with Avance Medical Service. We've obviously got the First Cash American with Ramsden's, and then we've got another one. We've got basically Prologis looking predatory, basically a big REIT in the States on for warehouses.
Segro,
And looking for Segro, all cash offer at around about net asset value of £9.25. How do you see this one developing?
Well, I was surprised it jumped up as much as it did. Here we are. I found it 24th of June, 2 days ago. It closed. I mean, this is a big, Segro is one of the biggest REITs in the UK, isn't it? I think it's European logistics warehouses type things, isn't it? 12 billion market cap. And it rose, I think, about 17% on the day, and it held for the whole, you know, so the market is looking at this very, very seriously. Now, it is an all paper offer, which is not doesn't appeal. And I did look at the paper, and Prologis paper is very, very highly rated. However, one of my correspondents did flag up to me that that is because it's not just a property investor, it's also a property management group. So it has higher, it's seen as having higher quality earnings. So that's one of the reasons Prologis is on a much higher rating than Segro. So whereas I initially thought, oh, it looks overvalued, but I think it's more complex than that. But I mean, again, it just shines a light on the value in UK REITs. I think for the better quality, larger UK REITs, they shouldn't be at discounts to NAV at all, really. You could argue they maybe should even be at premiums now. So it just shines a light on the whole sector, which of course is interest rate sensitive. So that's just moved strongly in its favor as well. So I'm all over the REITs. I wish I had some spare cash to buy more of them, actually. So very nice, lively sector to look at. Yeah.
I mean, my the only head scratcher for this one is why that they've, you know, Prologis have offered their paper. Because essentially, you know, if it's a £12 billion or whatever it is, Segro at market cap, you know, Prologis is $130 billion, dollars. So they could easily raise this one in reasonably, you know, sort of like, you know, fast order. Really weird that they've decided to offer shares. It might well be that it's just been a sort of like just a starter. They know they're going to get battered back, and therefore they're going to come in with a big, you know, sort of like part cash or part shares. I don't know, but I'm with you. If it's on a paper for paper deal, then I just don't see it happening myself. I don't think it will. But given it was a really strange approach in terms of, you know, they've got the capability of putting cash, that explains why the shares are currently 880 compared to the 925, which says to me a deal is there to be done. All the Prologis need to do is to chuck a big lot of money into
to sweeten the deal off.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. But I mean, it's close enough to in theory, £9.25 valuation. It's pretty close to that, really, considering deal risk. So, I mean, Prologis to me are doing what you should do. They've got their paper up to a really lofty valuation, and then they use it as overvalued currency to make acquisitions. So, pretty smart, I would say, from their point of view. But if I held Segro, would I want to swap it for Prologis shares? No way.
No, sorry. I think we're on the same page. The point I was making was that the market, because the shares are currently trading at only a fairly small discount to the 925, the market is saying, we're going to get another bid here.
I understood your point. I was bringing an add-on point.
And I think it'll be over 10 quid. I think it'll be a minimum £5 cash and £5 shares, minimum, if not more cash than shares, but
could be. I mean, net tangible asset value for Segro is £9.25. So they pitched the offer bang on net tangible asset value, which is quite interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, it's such an interesting sector. I have to say,
Well, we've got our fourth barbarian hitting as well, EasyJet. We've obviously got US, US airplane sort of funder, and Castle Lake has made four approaches, all in cash, for the low-cost airline. We've talked about it before. Keep the price keeps going up and the shares keep going up. Its latest is £6.50. Do you want to fill us in on the details?
Yes, it was, wasn't it? £6. Yeah, that's right. We've had four approaches, £5.60, £6, £6.25, now £6.50. Rumours in the press are that if the number starts with a seven, they could be in with a chance here. And I think from the nuances of the RNSs from EasyJet and Castle Lake, it looks like they're getting close, doesn't it? Castle Lake said that they welcomed the board's constructive engagement in a nice, polite RNS out yesterday. And EasyJet said that I think they're now engaging. 9-day put up and shut up extension, which is very specific, isn't it? 9-day. So it looks to me like they could be getting inching closer to a deal here. So let's see let's wonder what Stelios thinks of it all. He would have been consulted, wouldn't he? It was his family, I think, hold 15%. So what do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I don't think he has been consulted yet, to be perfectly honest. But it has, what it's meant is that it's forced the board, Castle Lake has forced the board to start talking to them. And I think Castle Lake always knew it was going to basically be a higher six or seven or whatever it was. You know, it's going to be a higher bid than when they first started. Right. But it does. It also says that the board has probably spoken to some of the institutional investors, again, according to that speculation. And it is, it's a sort of like a clearing price. It's got to start with a seven now. As you write, I mean, I think you've said before, you know, if you go back a long time, it's still a very cheap price for landing slots, the brand itself, and obviously, you know, the holidays business. And Castle Lake probably aren't the best buyer of it either, because they haven't got that many synergies. I don't know. I mean, I would not be surprised if somebody has another look. Somebody else has a look at this. I know people have always said IAG is a potential trade buyer. It would fit a lot more logically with another airline. But hey, it's happy days for shareholders, because I can't see the price dropping significantly in the near term. Because if I was a betting man, I think Castle Lake will put a seven on it, and then what might happen is that then the trade buyers start then having that white knight type of approach and come over the top. They won't get involved in a bidding war, but they might come up over the top if they've got enough cash.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. I mean, certainly if you zoom out on the chart, the shares still look very, very low. And I'd just personally be surprised if the big holders are prepared to sort of cash out at this sort of level, which is quite historically low. And you have got very, very strong net tangible asset backing here as well. And of course, it shines a light on how cheap Jet2.com is. Very, very interesting. I mean, this is, I think, the top riser on my bonkers bargain basement bin that I did on the 20th of March, when I just said, look, the market's stupidly cheap. Here are my top 40 value GARP ideas. And the entire list is up over 10%, which is very unusual for that many stocks. And EasyJet, I think, is the highest one now. So it was an obvious, crushing bargain back in March, because of course people panic about the Iran war and whatnot and the fuel price going up. But as Lord Lee always says, you shouldn't be thinking 3 months ahead. As an equity investor, you should be thinking 3, 5, 10 years ahead. So the short termists are creating those buying and selling opportunities for us, really, aren't they?
How often do you look short term, Paul?
Well, yeah, okay.
Okay, let's go to another one. Let's go to Gamma Communications. These guys have put themselves up for sale. They do sort of business-to-business broadband, telephony, email, all the sort of communications for companies in the UK and Germany, largely small enterprises. They put themselves up for sale about 3 months ago. They had three interested bidders, but two of them, or two, three three parties that have disclosed were disclosable. Yeah. Two of them have now walked away. We've had the last one going, which is Provident Equity after Oakley did about a month ago, which just leaves one, Epiris. How do you see this one?
Yeah, but this was one where we thought there was a reasonable chance of a bid, wasn't there? But unfortunately, it looks like we were wrong on this particular one. Well, we don't know yet. But yeah, the Providence and Epiris thing was a consortium. And that consortium broke up 2 days ago when Providence Equity withdraws its bid interest. But Epiris then, a few minutes later, said, oh, well, actually, we're still interested. So I think it said it was considering its options still. So we're treating this as still being a live bid situation. So it does look good value. Quite a lot of my subscribers were discussing it the other day, saying, look, this thing is cheap. But we've discussed it quite a lot before, haven't we? We're not sure if it's a bit of a cigar butt stock or not. No net debt to think about. So yeah, potentially interesting. Not really my type of thing. So I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, the way I interpret this to be, okay, is price expectations. You had three interested parties who all knew the asset well. In fact, Oakley Capital have got exactly the same business with Daisy Telecommunications. That's it's Peter Dubens. So you've had three informed private equity or even trade buyers looking at, because they knew that this was a good asset to own. Now, it all comes down to price, okay? And I think because the company put the business up themselves, did the strategic review, they had a figure in their mind, okay? And there's a minimum clearing price, and I think that's too high for what the three of them were actually talking about, because I can remember Oakley saying they'd put about $1 billion in, which was they'd valued about $1 billion, which I think was about 11 quid. I've got a sneaky suspicion management are looking for like 13 or 14.
I remember you mentioning that sort of ballpark previously.
Yeah. And I think I think this deal is not going to happen if the price expectations of the selling, you know, of the board stay the same. Unless they re-energize the growth, they take it back in, carry on, and then get the top line moving and the margins up, and then it will be worth more, I think, to potential buyers. But this smells to me as a failed auction because of a gap in price expectations, not on the sort of quality. I think the asset's fine, but it's just where somebody's prepared to stump up the money.
Yeah, well, that all makes sense to me, but it's not really a company I know particularly well, so I can't really add anything else to that, Paul.
Okay, cool. We've got another one. We've got another one, M&A. IP Group, which is basically a venture capital listed business. One of its shareholders, the Railways Pension Scheme, has put an offer in at 59p plus another 11p almost for its Oxford Nanopore shares, giving a total of roughly around about 70p. I think the shares are currently about 63p. But the net asset value of IP Group is £1.05, I believe. So,
is it?
Yeah. I mean, this one, I just don't know what this has got. To me, when somebody does this, it looks like this isn't got a hope in hell of getting of being agreed. But what's your view?
I haven't looked at it properly, Paul. I think this was the one the readers were discussing it, saying the premium wasn't enough. But I suppose it depends on what the major shareholders want. If they just want a liquidity event, you know, sometimes they might just grab the money and run, really. So, yeah, no strong view from me either way on IP Group. I've never really, because this is the one with the royalties connected with anti-obesity drugs, isn't it?
No, I think that's a different one. This one owns...
Oh, is that a different one?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think this one basically owns a whole bunch of...
Oh, sorry, I'm looking at a different IP Group. Let me just put IP... Yeah, right. I think I've got the right one now. That would help, wouldn't it? No, it's coming up. No, sorry, I'm going around in circles here, Paul. I'm not sure I'm talking about the right company, so I'll shut up.
Yeah. All I would say is if you own it, then I can't see a deal happening anywhere near this. And the rail pension scheme, I mean, it hasn't got any synergies for this business. I don't know. I mean, it just smacks to me. If they sell at anything like these levels, it's desperation. It says that their investments have been terrible over the last 10 years. And, you know, exit right the board, you've done a bad job. So I just don't see this one happening, to be perfectly honest.
It seems very strange, a pension scheme bidding for something.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
They're not meant to do that, are they?
It's just bizarre. Okay, let's go to one you do own. Speculation ITV is about to basically sell the its media assets and its broadcasting business to Sky for the reported £1.6 billion. Pounds. Any quick thoughts on this one? Because then it would leave it with a very attractive just studios business.
Yeah, well, these bid rumours have been swirling for years, haven't they? What's strange really is that the price is still, there's a sort of magnet pulling the price to 80p, isn't there, with ITV? Just to clarify, I'm not actually currently holding this. I did sell them earlier this year, I think it was, to recycle the money into Brave Bison, which I think has better upside. And that's gone quite well so far. So, no, I haven't really been closely following this one, ITV. I mean, it always looks attractively cheap, doesn't it? 6% yield, the pension scheme's all been dealt with. That's done and dusted. PE of 9 or thereabouts. So it always looks good value, but I think it just has that overhang where people say, oh, it's terrestrial telly, we're not interested. Whereas actually it's two divisions. And so look at the chart. It just goes nowhere, does it really? So, I mean, it also they give valuations, but we don't know how that's calculated. Is that including or excluding debt? You know, so I can't really value it at the moment, so I don't know. Have you got any thought? You're the merger and acquisitions king, so what do you think?
I must admit, I did a sum of the parts on this one. It was about 2 months ago, and I'm convinced, there's a strong probability that once they sell that broadcasting business and those media assets to Sky, their studios business is really well thought of. And that's exactly the type of asset that Netflix have been looking for at the moment. They tried and failed to buy Paramount in the States. They've also, I think, just put a bid in for a studios business. I think this is somewhere in Europe. I think it was France, if I remember rightly. About not quite as big as the studios business ITV. So what they want is good, creative, sort of like, you know, studios and people and directors to be able to create content for them. And I just think this will be a real crown jewel asset once that Sky thing happens. The problem is that's not an actual, when you think about it, putting Sky and Comcast together with ITVs, that's going to go through a pretty serious CMA review itself.
So I was just thinking that.
I wouldn't jump into the Netflix potential final takeover until that deal happens. Let it be all on its own, and then Netflix could welcome knocking the door, because it'd be the kind of asset they would absolutely love, I'm sure. UK's well thought of for its studios.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And we're a world leader in that space, aren't we? And there's very good studios and very good tax incentives and so on. So it could be one of these kind of linked deal things you're saying, really, aren't you? Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Oh, well, I shall follow that one with interest, but I'm not likely to revisit the shares, I don't think, for ITV. You can only focus on a certain number of things, can't you?
Yeah, good. Okay, we've got Drew. He's asking about Avingtrans. Basically, these guys are sort of the niche engineering business that make parts that go into like HVAC systems for data centers, also lots of pumps and really quite specialist equipment and kit that goes into nuclear, both decommissioning life extension and new nuclear, plus defense, plus blast proof doors and stuff. I mean, they're all over they're all into all of major secular growth areas. Plus, they've got in their medical business, they've got an MRI business, a 3D X-ray, and a quantum computing. So they've got lots of growth engines. Anyway, they came out with news this week. Do you want to take us through what your latest thoughts on it are?
Yeah, well, I finally saw the light on this one last September when I moved it up from amber to amber green. And the reason for that was because all the things you'd been talking about and other bulls had been talking about with Avingtrans started to show up in the numbers last September. So that's why I upped my view on it. And we've stayed at amber green ever since. So yeah, we like this one, Avingtrans. Dave, my colleague, wrote about it 2 days ago. We had a trading update for the May year end, which was in line. There were a couple of relatively minor negatives in there, weren't they? Paying back $5 million of COVID loans. They've decided to do as the best thing. I mean, that's what, 2% of the market cap. So you just make a one-off adjustment for that. So that doesn't really matter that much. Rather limited outlook commentary, we thought. But overall, we like it. We think Avintrans, it's a basket of interesting things, as you correctly say, I think, Paul. So yeah, your view?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the medical business ultimately will get spun off. It's now run by Stuart Gall, who was the CEO of Intelligent Ultrasound, who sold that business to J&J. So this guy is taking over a high potential, potentially very fast growing, you know, imaging business. And I'm sure they'll either spin it off or they'll sell that. That'll leave them, the quantum business will be very interesting extra bit they've got. And then that engineering, they can decide what they want to do with that, because they've got lots of interesting positions that they could do. If they ever wanted to sell something off at a very big price, I mean, the multiples for these type of businesses, particularly in the States where they do a lot of work, are enormous. I mean, you know, you're talking 15 to 20 times EBITDA, and the shares are still trading at sort of like, you know, 10 times EBITDA for these type of businesses. So there's lots of values in that business on the sum of the parts basis. So I think it's just as, I mean, they've had a great record, the two Steves, and you just stick with them and they'll realize that value as and when it's appropriate. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there is a premium here for management, because going back to a point I was talking about earlier with Lord Lee, you have to, for these buy and build type businesses, or buy, improve, sell, or whatever they call them, the key thing you have to look into is what have management achieved in the past, because there's lots of wannabe deal makers, aren't there, who often destroy value. But the people like the Avintrans lot, who I think have got a very good track record, haven't they, over a long period of time for buying and selling businesses, they're the ones to back usually, aren't they?
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, let's move sectors. We've got ProFang59 asking about distribution finance capital holdings. These guys are the lender and a bit of a bank, actually, but they do all the lending for things like motorhomes, caravans, motorcycles, off-road vehicles, large. I think it's all in the UK, but their net interest margins are about 7%. I mean, they're phenomenal. Anyway, they came out with some results today. The shares are up again another 10%. What's your latest on this one?
Yeah, I like it. I must admit, people who were keen on the stock did work on me to give it a chance. And over a period of time, I kind of was dragged kicking and screaming into the bull camp on this one. Yeah, I do. I think it's one of these alternative lenders where the mainstream banks do seem to have largely withdrawn from that type of funding after bad experiences. And they have left a gap in the market that these guys seem to be doing well in. I mean, you always have to question the provisioning policy, and could there be awful stuff lurking in the in the receivables book? But anyway, the update was today, actually, wasn't it? And they were up 10% when I last looked. H1 trading update, very good. The aggregate loan book is up 25%. I'm not really interested in that. I want to know whether they're going to get paid back by the customers, not what the gross size of the book is. But anyway, materially ahead of market expectations, they say, for calendar 2026. And I have to say, generally with these alternative lenders, because there's a few of them that we quite like, Funding Circle, don't we, you and I? And then there's Time Finance, and there are a few of these things that actually all look, I think, pretty reasonable. But Cavendish has raised the forecast earnings 9% for DFCH. Obviously, if you got into a bad recession, these guys get absolutely walloped, don't they? But I have been surprised how relatively benign the bad debts for these type of businesses have been, despite, you know, the much advertised tough macro. You know, maybe the macro isn't quite as bad as the media keep telling us. I don't know. So, yeah, I quite like it. Forward P is only 7x or something. Doesn't seem to pay divvies. So maybe it's in that sort of accumulate, reinvest type of phase. But, yeah, I would say a cautious thumbs up from me for Distribution Finance Capital Holdings. Yeah.
I think their USP for lending is basically they are by far and away the number one for motorhomes and for caravans and static caravans. So I think there's a sort of like a relationship type of, sort of magic dust that they, you know, it isn't structuring deals. It's just on relationships. It's knowing the dealers. It's knowing the, you know, the distributors, the owners of these properties, and therefore effectively you become the go-to people that when they need something financed, that you're the only person they ring. So I think that's where they've got their USP and why they've done so well. But I'm with you. The business model hasn't yet probably been fully tested in a downturn. But
I think we might have had a call with management on this, didn't we? Maybe about a year ago.
No, I didn't know.
I might have done. I think the loans are quite short term, aren't they? Are they 6 or 9 months or something?
I think they're about 150 days. So
what's that, about 5 months? Is it stock holding, isn't it? It's to finance demonstrator vehicles and things like that. Well, actually, I could see that would be a nice niche where you could understand why the customer would pay a 7% interest margin, and your chances of them defaulting in that 5 month is probably quite low, isn't it? Mm. So do we know, do they make installments or do they pay it in a lump sum when they sell the vehicle?
I don't know how it actually works, no. But anyway, they're doing brilliantly, so the shares have done great. Yeah, they are.
So well done to shareholders, you've done well on that one.
Okay, let's go through all things electrification. We've got Dan JW and David Raywood both asking about Volex. They came out with results this week, did they? Anyway, these guys have special sort of like cables and gadgets, or effectively connectors that go into things like data centers, EVs, medical equipment. But the data center part is just literally gone through the roof for them. Mm. Shares have done phenomenally well over the past year or so.
Sorry, I'm just trying to suppress a hiccup.
That's all right. Yeah,
I never hiccup normally, but when I'm doing podcasts, it's ridiculous. So yeah, we have full year results for March out yesterday on Volex. I looked at it pre-open and I thought, well, these are really good figures. PBT up 24%, EPS up 20%. So lovely numbers, but we know they'd be making out like bandits on the data centers. So that is kind of a known factor. And it was, so yes, lovely numbers. But you obviously, when that happens, you start asking, well, how long does that boom continue, don't you? And the market can shift quite quickly from that. So it looks from the chart as if that's what the market's now perhaps doing. It was a 3% beat about consensus. And current year trading, which is March 27, it says was strong, but in line. When I suppose you could argue, being devil's advocate, when you get a share price sort of almost starting to go exponential like that in recent months, in line isn't enough. But you would imagine they would probably be hoping to beat rather than meet. So I'm a little bit perplexed that it's fallen back as much as it has. Might be worth a fresh look, actually, as maybe one to nip in and catch a bounce. I don't know. I mean, it's fundamentally a good business, though, I think, Volex.
Yeah, and there's a massive arbitrage valuation opportunity between probably the US number one, which is Amphenol, which is, last time I looked, it was on 30 times PE. And I can't remember what Volex is on, but about 15, is it, or something, 16?
Yeah, it would be now after dropping back a bit. Yeah, about 15.
I mean, that sounds like another US barbarian at the gate. Yeah. You know, you just come in and just like, okay, it's loose change to Amphenol and you just buy Volex because you just automatically get that uplift in your market cap just by absorbing it.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Nat Rothschild's obviously the key player with Volex, who's probably bobbing around off the coast of Corfu on his super yacht, because apparently that's where he likes to run the business from. But I mean, he's done a great job, him and his team at Volex. They took on something that was pretty, a bit of a mess, actually. And over 5 years, they've really straightened it out beautifully and gone a bit lucky, maybe, with the data center boom as well. But they've, hats off to them. They've done such a great job there, I think. Really impressive.
Yeah, and you've got also with Nat Rothschild, I mean, he's been through the... I know he's obviously come from a very famous family, but actually he had a lot of flack when he was the CEO of Bumi. You remember that coal business out in Indonesia?
No.
Yeah, he was the chairman of it or something, or the CEO. Right. He floated it, and then they had real problems I think they had a big fraud and corruption, and it went to zero, I believe. But anyway, that was it was a long time ago. It was about 50. So he's picked himself off the floor, and done this, and you've got to happen to go through such a sort of like a really problem being the top guy listing it and bringing it to the market.
Yeah.
To have that such a big problem about and to do it, you've got to have. So I told him, this guy's got super resilience, and he's coming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know him, and I've never spoken to him, but in the back of my mind, I've always wondered, obviously with the family name and all the huge wealth and everything, whether this project at Volex was kind of maybe for him to demonstrate, look, I'm a serious businessman. I can. Build and improve this thing, and he's well, obviously it's a team of people doing that, but hats off to them. We won't have any hats left at this rate. I mean, he's he's done a great job.
Okay, well, we're gonna go to the other one. We go to the shock profit warning of the week. We've got Grant asking about Telecom Plus. These guys do bundling of all your utilities like water bills, energy, broadband, mobile, I don't know, hot tea, any service you want, they bundle it in. Anyway, they've got this 5-year plan, and they had a trading update saying that they need to invest a lot more money into the business to get their strategic achievements. Shares didn't respond favorably. What was your take?
Well, shocked, I think, like everybody. Look at this was seen as a sort of rock solid growth income stock, wasn't it, up until a year ago. And look, I mean, it's lost 2/3 of its value. I really feel for people who've held this throughout all of this, because I still think it's fundamentally a good company. My reading of the new strategic plan is I think it's gone X growth. And I think they are basically having to do something pretty radical in terms of, they talk about £55 million a year of investment. It's not, it's price cutting. I mean, I know there's other stuff in there as well, so it's not entirely price cutting. But I think to get it competitive again, they've just had to bite the bullet and said, look, you know, we can't generate the growth we want whilst maintaining these margins. So that's the way I see it. I could be wrong, but the results were okay. But again, largely X growth, really, only mid-single digit revenue and profit growth. So they've taken an axe to that with the strategic plan. I'm tempted to buy a few, I've got to say, because this, again, it's got a lot of founder shareholdings in it. And I thought it explained the new strategy pretty well in the RNS. So I was surprised that it ended the day down 26%. What are they now? That was £7.10. Have they bounced at all?
They're £7.80. 82.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So it's bounced 10% from the day one drop. So, drat. I missed that one. Should have bought some.
Nothing like looking for 5 years in front of it, Paul.
Well, I think in an early stage bull market, which is, I think, what we're in for small caps, I changed my strategy completely. I'm sorry, buy and hold. There's no moral superiority with buy and hold. If you see opportunities to make money fast, grab them, you know? So I think, I think this is actually worth a look at this level, Telecom Plus. Yeah.
What's quite interesting, actually, when you say we're on a bull market, is that the news this week that the government is going to tax cash held in ISAs. Mm. And so what that in cash ISAs and stocks and shares ISAs. So what that means, for certainly for people like me, I mean, I'm a wife, I've got quite large ISAs, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we cash out of something like, which we have done this week, Spire and Advanced Medical, puts quite a bit of cash available. Well, there's no, we're going to deploy it in shares. Yeah. So what that means is that people like me and lots of other professional investors are basically not going to wait around, in terms of shares to go up, because there's going to be a flood of cash eventually coming into the market. And that, I think that law changes in April, but it's going to start from now as much as anything, I think. Mm.
So anyway, it's incentivizing you to put the money to work in shares rather than just leaving it earning interest. But is the tax effect on that big enough to change your behavior? Is it?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, it's 22%. I mean, they haven't done it your marginal tax. They've done it at just straight flat 22%.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It doesn't sound enough to make me want to fundamentally change my investing strategy, but I don't know.
It didn't fundamentally change, but I won't be leaving cash in my ISA, basically.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to be deploying it for the ISA, I'll be, you know, putting it into stocks and shares. And I just think there's a lot of cash. I can't remember how many tens of billions there is in the UK sitting in cash. Well, you know, you effectively lost all the tax advantage of interest-free, you know, tax-free interest in your ISAs, cash and stocks and shares. There's going to be more people like myself who basically say, okay, well, I'm going to put it into stocks. I mean, I'll put mine up nearly all in stocks, but it's just going to accelerate when I do. I think that's going to be a good, that could be a good lift for shares, to be perfect guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously designed to nudge people to actually deploy the cash into. Mind you, a couple of the readers, Gerald and DDT, have said it's just tax on the interest rather than they're not taxing the actual cash. So yeah, we he's absolutely right. We knew that, but that's why I personally don't think it's going to make that much difference. But it might be a positive nudge factor. I don't think we can really complain about this particular measure.
Okay, cool. We've got Rebecca asking about Moonpig, which I know you're all over this sector because you own Card Factory with old funkypigeon.com, isn't it? But anyway, let's go to Moonpig, the number one online sort of like card producer. Came out with results this week. I think they responded okay, actually.
Yeah, they were good. We like this one. We're amber green on this as well, which is 4 out of 5 star. Results were good. That were yesterday. PBT was up 13%, but it's doing really substantial buybacks. So that inflated the EPS growth to 20%. You've got to be a bit careful when companies are doing aggressive buybacks, not to imagine that that's all organic growth and put it on a PE of 20 because it's growing at EPS at 20. You know, it should be on a PE of 13 because that's the underlying growth, which it is. So it's on a reasonable PE of 13. You've got 2% yield, but substantial buybacks. They did 9% of the market cap. But the balance sheet doesn't really support that. The balance sheet is weak, but not dangerously weak. Inline update. So, yeah, we like it. We think Moonpig looks good. And Funky Pigeon is less than a tenth of the size of Moonpig. Mm. So it's, you know, it's not a major challenger by any means. But I think I wouldn't be surprised. Give it time. And Card Factory could develop Funky Pigeon into something that might, you know, start to eat into Moonpig. But that, I think, is not an imminent threat. So, yeah, I think Moonpig looks good, actually. I was quite surprised. It gave up most of its gains yesterday. It opened up about 10% and it closed only up 3%. So, yeah, and that chart looks nice, doesn't it? Cockney Rebel will be all over this. That looks like a bowl. Looks like a bowl to me.
But just stepping back, sort of the industry, okay?
Yeah.
If you look at media, or certainly sort of like physical newspapers and press, basically it's in permanent decline, Certainly physical newspapers has been for a long time.
Oh, yes.
And effectively online news has been in permanent decline because it's just been taken out by, you know, all these social media guys. They don't make, you know, okay, other than the Daily Mail, maybe on advertising, on online mail, but there's very few news, even online news, which make money. What's the sort of the growth profile of sending cards, either physical or online, going forward?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. My colleague, my co-writer, John, did a more detailed review of Moonpig yesterday. And there were some quite interesting things in that, actually, about growth opportunities with customizing, creating sort of unique, personalized cards. You know, they're really investing in developing the offering. And, you know how tech savvy younger people are and whatever. I mean, I know you were talking, I think, with Rebecca on the comments section yesterday, weren't you, about this? And I think she was saying her kids, she's got quite a few kids, and they use it as much as anything to be reminded of birthdays for loved ones. And they'll actually do a creative, bespoke card in a way that is totally different from just buying something off the shelf. So I think it, and with AI and all that sort of thing, then you can add a mug with it for, you know, with a picture of your mum on it or whatever. Yeah, I think it's got a lot more mileage in it than maybe just the bog standard greetings cards. So I think there is growth potential there, and very nice margins. It makes something like a 20% PBT margin. By far the market leader. So international expansion is another potential. So I think there is growth potential for Moonpig.
Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, frankly, I'm definitely not a knowledgeable consumer in this area.
Well, sure. I'm not either. I was just reading what John wrote.
Okay. So we'll move on. But that was a good one. Okay, we've got Clark Sean. He's asking about Gear for Music. These guys have done unbelievable over the last couple of years. They were sort of written off for dead about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I think a lot of their competitors went out of business, and they've won by this survivor bias by buying cheap stock from their competitors who've gone bust and taking their shelf space. The shares have just keep going from strength to strength. Is this one going to continue playing the nice tunes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this one paid for my penthouse in Bournemouth. On the long term, it did two massive multi-bagging moves, and I caught both of them. Yeah, I caught both of them.
Wow!
And the first one literally paid for my penthouse where I live now. I just bought it outright with the profit I made on Gear for Music. So I love this company as a result. Is it going to do? Is it going to be a three-humped camel? Looking at that chart, I don't know. But I have to say, it is good value. You know, owner managed again. Andy was, I think, runs it. You know, very tenacious, and you know, the figures were really good. Revenue up 30%, PBT up 550%. Obviously, from a lowish base, which is ahead of market expectations. It's lovely. And on these new, much, much higher profit numbers, it's on a PE of about 8 or 9. So I totally get it why bulls are saying, look, actually, this thing's still cheap. And as you say, the key development, which I didn't spot on a timely basis, unfortunately, because I sold mine at about £1.20 a couple of years ago. So I missed this latest doubling or tripling. It was that the sector was so tight for margins, the competitors were just falling by the wayside. So you're right. It's last man standing type situation, isn't it? Gear for Music. Very well done to people who had the insights on this. And they've straightened out their balance sheet. They're increasing their warehouse distribution capacity. It does have a limited competitive advantage. You know, it's almost certainly not going to be, you know, it'll never get to a 15, 20% operating margin or whatnot. And you've got the big German competitor, Thomann. I think they've actually been a beneficiary from Brexit because, of course, it's difficult for Thomann to get and costly to get product into the UK now. So I think this is actually a hidden beneficiary of Brexit.
Yeah. Well, as you say, if we get another hump to that camel, then you'll be buying a third penthouse, won't you, Dan, in Bournemouth?
No, two's enough.
Okay. All right. Well, let's stay in this sort of the consumer. Let's go to private label products. Me and Paul spoke to the CEO, Chris Smith of McBride.
Oh, yes.
Yesterday. Fascinating. These guys are the Europeans' biggest private label manufacturer. They do things like household cleaners, aerosols and detergents and soaps and stuff like that for the supermarkets throughout Europe, Carrefour, Tesco's, Morrison's and stuff. But they also do some contract manufacturing as well for some of the big brands, people like Reckitt and Benckiser and Unilever and people like that around Europe. Fascinating. We had the big question that Paul and I had was, are the EBIT margins sustainable at about 7% going forward, given the buying power that the supermarkets have? What was your takeaway anyway? What was your thoughts?
Oh, this was a fabulous call. Thanks so much for setting it up. I really, really enjoyed mainly listening to you and Chris, the CEO, who's the former CFO. I think he moved up to CEO, which usually doesn't work, I have to say. But in this case, it really has. Look at that. Mm. I mean, it was an amazing turnaround from a really perilous situation. I mean, at that low point, it was on the brink of going bust. But one of the points he made yesterday was that he said, look, we have so much, we're so significant to the supermarkets. They didn't want us to go bust. So I think for other people have made this point as well. For a while, the supermarkets let it make bigger profit margins to rebuild its balance sheet, which it's done successfully. But he did give us, I thought, excellent reasons for why they think they can actually maintain this. He said, you know, they've got factories working 24/7 with shifts, you know, very few staff, automated factories mainly, which have to be near to market because it's low value, heavy products. So they're not up against Chinese competition because you can't bring in bottles of bleach or whatever economically from China. I think it's a much better business than I realized, actually. And basically, it's a negotiation process, he was saying, when a 3-month negotiation process when input costs shoot up. They haggle, and ultimately they will put the supermarkets on stop if they unreasonably refuse to pay a surcharge. I think it's mainly surcharges they put in, but they have to demonstrate to the supermarket, look, this plastic cost has gone up. Here are our workings. I think it's almost open book costing, I think. He didn't say that, but that was the impression I got. So they've just warned on profits in 12th of June, but I wasn't bothered by that because they said, look, there's just a 3-month time lag, basically, between costs spiking up and us getting through the price rises. So this is just a temporary factor. And presumably that'll work to their advantage as the plastics costs come back down again. I don't know. So yeah. I was very impressed. I think there's further upside on the share, potentially medium, longer term. And really hands-on detail man, you know, he was all over everything, wasn't he? Which is exactly what I want. I don't want a gravel-voiced, grey-suited, you know, I shouldn't say that, BS merchant. I want a hands-on entrepreneur who knows exactly how every aspect of his business works. And he's saying to his staff, what about this? Have you done this? You know, so he was absolutely that type of CEO. So top draw, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, loved it.
Yeah, and certainly what sort of surprised me was how much value add they do for the supermarkets.
Yes,
I mean, they're essentially an outsourcer of the innovation process for a lot of, you know, basically supermarket-owned brands. So they come to the supermarket with ideas about, you know, sort of like formulations, bottle sizes, packaging, environmental awareness. So essentially it takes all of that complexity and hassle out of the hands of the supermarkets and is taken on board. So that gives them a seat at the table in terms of defending that 7% margin. The other thing is that they're head and shoulders above anybody else, head and shoulders above anybody else in terms, they don't do shampoos, I don't think, not yet, but they may do. They're head and shoulders above anybody else in terms of size. So if people like Tesco's and Carrefour want serious distribution, then there aren't that many people they can go to. And then importantly, the actual supply demand balance for own label products is actually pretty tight. Not so much in sort of like powder detergents where it's been around for ages, but certainly things like dishwasher tablets and all the other stuff, there just isn't enough of them in supply. And you can understand why, because the brands have been losing market share and want to actually stop manufacturing. Basically own labels been increasing the amount of volume they're selling. So basically you've got a pretty tight market, plus you've got, they're effectively doing the innovation process for the supermarkets for all of these cleaners. So I actually think, surprisingly, and I'm going to meet my words on this one, I actually think he's got a better than even chance of keeping that 7% because that business does a lot of really high value stuff that the supermarket can't replicate, because it's not going to employ an innovation team to sort all its household detergents out in terms of private label. And just as importantly, Tesco's customers demand private label. They will not turn up in their shops unless there's own label. And these, so they do have a really important part of the mix.
Yeah, those are great points, actually. I haven't been through my notes yet with my highlighter to highlight the main points, but those were the main points. And he said, I said to him at the end, that was just a masterclass in how this sector works, because, you know, I'm a generalist. I don't have that level of knowledge. And it was fascinating. He said the perception and studies and surveys have shown that if you haven't got, you know, a really competitive dishwasher tablet product, then the customer will perceive your whole store as expensive. And that was so interesting, wasn't it? A psychological thing.
Yeah.
And he says, we overclean products. He says, actually, he said, we wash, you know, our clothes far more than it's needed, really. And the actual basic cleaning process is overkill. So he said they're now, customers are focusing as much as anything on fragrance. And they have over 50 types of different lemon fragrances. I mean, it was a fascinating call, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Actually, I might see if he'll come on my podcast. But I hope that's not going to tread on your toes, Paul.
No, not at all. No, but they've only got, in just terms of valuation, I think the shares are about seven and a half times PE.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
they're not expensive, even though they've tripled, you know, over the last 3 years.
Quadrupled. And you do have a little bit of a cash drain from the pension scheme, but it's not a huge amount. So I would maybe add 1 point onto the PE for that. But yeah, I think 20-30% upside wouldn't surprise me on this. I could see McBride shares being £2 plus. Yeah. If you're patient. So yeah. No, I mean, very, very positive call. And it was fascinating. It was, you wouldn't think washing tablets and whatnot could actually be an interesting topic, but it was.
Yeah, no, it got the tick from me. Okay. And then we had another chat also with sort of professional services accountant MHA. They listed on AIM about a year ago, raising, I think, about 96 million quid a pound. The shares are currently 134, so they're up over 30% subsequently. And we spoke to their CEO, Rakesh Shaunak, who was absolutely fabulous in terms of very unassuming. But again, he's been there for a long time. He was an ex-partner. And he talked us through why they listed, why they went for, you know, become an IPO rather than selling to private equity, and what their growth strategy is. And they're aiming over the next 5 years to double their revenue. Anyway, what was your take on our discussions?
Very positive again with Rakesh. Mm. Again, the type of entrepreneur, the type of CEO I like, just someone who's, as you say, unassuming, matter of fact, down to earth, just getting on with running the business. That's what I want. That's what I look for. So he very much ticked the box for me in terms of a CEO I'd be happy to back. MHA, the accountancy firm, obviously it's done well since floating. Which is great to see. We need more successful IPOs. He said that their tax sector is doing well. They're not chasing business on price. They are offering a sort of complete service. But, I mean, all the accountancy firms say similar things. So I probably shouldn't say this, but his off the side comment about Rachel Reeves was he just said it calmly, not hysterically. He just said Rachel's created mayhem. Which I hope I won't get into trouble for quoting him as saying that. But anyway, 90% of the business is a wide range of services, he says, rather than individual product lines. And they've got a nice clear policy, haven't they, of just strategy of buying complementary bolt-on acquisitions. And you can see how that will add value. They're using AI, they're passing on their higher costs to clients. I mean, he answered all your questions, I thought, very well.
Yeah.
So I think MHA, I'm not going to buy any. But I wouldn't put anyone off buying or holding the shares, put it like that. There could be, and actually, looking at that chart on the screen, that looks to me, given that the business fundamentals are all sound and everything's fine, maybe it's a bit of a trade there for a bit of a bounce. But the others are cheap. FRP Advisory is cheap. Begbies are cheap, although they are more insolvency practitioners. Yeah. So it's worth looking at. Maybe buy all three. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite interesting, actually. I asked him why he basically decided to IPO, become public listed.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas most of the accountants go of basically saying to private equity to buy and build. And he basically said, look, culturally wise, we weren't aligned with the sort of like the short term, you know, sort of like demands of private equity, where it's basically, you know, fire a shed load of people, make a shed load of cash, and then flip it on in 3 or 4 years at a profit. Yeah. We're a long term sort of like, you know, business, and we want that sort of like valued loyalty from our employees. And so that, you know, that certainly chimed with me in terms of the culture of the actual business. And it was aligned to what he was like. And then just in terms of valuation, I mean, the sales are about 250 at the moment, 250 million, I think, at the moment. They want to get to 500 million. And I asked him how he's getting what the gap is. And he says, well, over the next 3 to 5 years, we'll put another 100 million on the top line through organic growth, which is like high single digits, 10% type per annum growth. And then the other 150 will come through M&A. And now if you actually do look at what they need, and you assumed a sort of 8x EBITDA on that M&A, if you assumed how much money they would need from that plus their internal generate, you get a valuation of about 220 per share. So this looks like a good, solid business that's got a growth strategy. So if anybody wants, it should be a relatively low risk, regulatory protected business that is effectively winning market share from the big four, simply because they're cheaper and they've got a good sort of like, you know, clients and they do a good service. So I think they're, you know, they're well placed.
Yeah, I agree. And then one other point, just a final point on this one. I did challenge him on the accountancy firms that had floated, how that introduced a conflict of interest between the paying the partners their, you know, huge 600,000-700,000 a year plus remuneration, and the payments of dividends to the outside shareholders. And he pushed back very hard on that, and he said, actually, I don't think there is a conflict of interest. He said, we're all shareholders as well. So he said, we want the dividends. It's part of our remuneration. So I was quite, I have to say, he was very persuasive on that, and did make me think again that, well, maybe there actually isn't a conflict of interest there.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think he's got 141, I think he said, partners still in there who now own equity. And that equates to over 50% of the share capital. So,
Gosh. Well, that speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So they're out. They've got plenty of skin in the game. Okay. Yeah. We've got just a few questions we'll mop up. We've got WMin13 asking about just generally low margin retailers, things like AO World and Halfords. What's your view on them in terms of, you know, potential investments?
Well, funnily enough, I was talking about this last night on my podcast. Several of them have done better than I expected, actually. The Works, Procook, and Halfords are all kind of around the 3% PBT margin, which for me says they've got no pricing power. And it doesn't, you know, one of the key variables could alter and clobber a 3% margin. That is my thing on that. But having said that, all three, the shares have done pretty well. Yeah. Halfords in particular, my colleague John is very bullish on it, and it's one of his biggest shares. He wrote up an excellent piece in on my website yesterday on this, which really did get, you know, say he thinks there's good bull arguments, and he's running Halfords. He reckon it's, despite the big rise, he reckon it could be worth £3 a share. Look at that chart move. It's been a great call. He's done really well on it. And similarly, The Works I would describe as a pretty marginal, lowish quality business, because it was only making 1-2% PBT margin. That's done better than expected. Shares have done well. So this is all rather encouraging, isn't it? And it's nice to see people actually, Currys have done well. Yeah. AO World we think is good.
Yeah.
And Currys we like. We think both of them are performing well. I think a lot of these businesses have been through so much difficulties in the last, 7-8 years, that the survivors are now maybe just stronger, leaner, better run businesses. So isn't it interesting, this desperately out of favor sector of these smaller, more marginal retailers, they seem to be doing pretty well, don't they? So my sector pick, as I say, is Card Factory, and that never goes anywhere. But you get lovely divvies from it. So, and that makes a decent profit margin, about 9 or 10%. So its day will come, I think. But lovely to see consumer stocks coming into the focus. Hollywood Bowl, I think, is dirt cheap. There's a lot of, I mean, quite a few of these things, but unfortunately not the ones that have just doubled or whatever.
Okay, we've got Nigel Backhai, 680. He's basically asking about NIOX, which I think is the asthma diagnostics business. Shares have dropped off after their bid from Keensight, I think it was, a year ago, at 81p per share. Shares are 55p for a really high quality business. What's your views on this one? Got any quick thoughts?
Well, not very much. So I'll mainly let you answer this one, Paul. But this came up on one of my screens the other day as a potential buy the dip thing. So, and I have looked at it in the past, and I think it's a real, really nice business, a nice quality business. And the Mills, Christopher and Nick Mills, I think were raving about this one. So I think this looks worth a look. But over to you. You know more about it than me.
Yeah, I would say, Nigel, it's right on my watch list, this one. I mean, I actually think it's going to get taken out at some point in time. The deal originally with Keensight was only disrupted because of the tariff turmoil we had last year in April of 2025. I'm sure Keensight would want to pick these up. They are the dominant players in asthma and COPD diagnostics around the world, and they've got a really good growth trajectory, and one in terms of just in clinical, in sort of like asthma, but also they've got this big research product with activity with COPD, again sort of doing diagnostics there, but for developing drugs. And if any of those drugs come through, then they'll be doing the diagnostics on the patients for those treatments afterwards. So yeah, I like it. They are the only slight downside is they are, you know, and I wouldn't class them as it, but it's just an easy term to use, a one trick pony. It's basically all, it's all sort of pheno testing, which is a breath testing. And so if there's ever anybody ever had a better mouse trap in pheno testing or diagnostics, would be a bit, but they have just had a deal with, I think they just locked up their supplier who's got the best sensor.
That's right. 10-year exclusive.
Cutting a long story short, Nigel, I like it a lot, and it's certainly something I would buy. I don't own it now, but I don't think I don't know, who knows, but I'd be stunned if those remain public, that the NIOX remains public within 3 years. I think somebody will come up and put a number on them again.
Yeah, and we had a year-to-date trading in-line statement on the 21st of May. It's got a net cash balance sheet as well, about 10% of the market cap. So, yeah, it ticks a lot of my boxes, this one, Paul. I would definitely say people could take a fresh look and let us know what you think. So,
On the potential takeover targets, we've got DDT4Real. He's asking about your company, Brickability, or Brick. What's your view on this one? Shares are unbelievably cheap again.
Oh, they are.
They're 49p, and I think, did they have a bid at 65?
65.
And that was cheeky.
Yeah, it's bonkers. I just think it's very nice, and it keeps churning out. Dividend yield is now higher than the PE. Balance sheet's not the best, let's be honest about that. But they basically turned away a 65p bid from Atlas Holdings, a US private equity, which specializes in buying up distribution type businesses. So it was a good fit. So yeah, if they come back with a higher price, I mean, why would management want to sell? I think management have got reasonable holdings themselves, or a former vendor of one of the subsidiaries, I think, has. So why would they want to sell, when the industry is at a cyclical low? But I think Brook is lovely. I mean, I just hope that we're not going to get some awful update from it for something unforeseen. But it reassures every time it puts out trading updates, despite tough macro, still seems to be doing well. So yeah, I'm just going to hold it for the duration. I don't make my buy and sell decisions based on what the share price is doing. Do you know what I mean? I'm completely detached from that. Obviously, if it relentlessly falls and you do start to question your judgment. But for me, based on the fact that the news flow is consistently good from Brook, I'd be looking to buy more, not sell them. And you accept that the odd one will go wrong. You know, that's the way it works, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, quick one on, we've got Severfield. Lorenzo's asking about the turnaround strategy. They came down a lot, haven't they? We're about 85p in October last year, and they're 32 now. I think these guys do structural steel, don't they? And they didn't have a lot of one-off costs with the bridge was one, and I think there were some closure costs and stuff like that. Anyway, cut the long story short, what's your view?
It's had a lot of problems, as you know, as we can see from the share price. I think this could go either way. To sit on the fence here, I think if nothing else goes wrong and they trade their way out of the previous problems, I think this could be double the current price in a recovery. And you would think, with all the infrastructure spending going on, that structural steel would be pretty buoyant. The last update was 23rd of June. What was that? That was earlier this week, wasn't it? Full year results. Not great. Profit down 42%. Slight miss against consensus. But it confirmed in line for the new financial year. Wafer thin margins, though. You're only looking at about a 3% net profit margin when you've got quite a considerable amount of product risk, as you correctly said, for the bridge remediation work was bloody expensive. And they were able to claim on some of that on the insurance. But what's the insurance premiums will be a hell of a lot higher now, I bet. So I think it could go either way. Debt is not too bad, and they did refinance the bank facilities in June. So if the bank are happy, that is usually a good sign, isn't it? So I wouldn't try and dissuade our reader from this one. I think it could be interesting, but maybe one where I'd probably have a stop loss in place. I don't normally use formal stop losses, but if it really starts to tank again, or if there's some bad news, I think it would be one to sell on the opening bell. Yeah. But providing that there's no more bad news, I think you could do well on this. But
I think it just comes to me. It comes down like brickability and a lot of the other building type products and stuff like that. I know it doesn't do houses, Severfield, but it does, things for things, warehouses and other construction, right, things, stuff like that. So it all depends on your view on the macro, in my view. If you believe that Andy Burnham, when he comes in, is going to push the infrastructure button and we're going to start getting more warehouses built, data centers and stuff like that, I think it could do very well. So it's basically one of those leverage play, the high beta play on the economy, GDP plus.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although you've obviously got quite a long lag, haven't you, between projects being planned but the steelwork would be relatively, probably medium in the cycle, wouldn't it? But
Okay, we've got a top dogger. He's complimenting you on your slick haircut there, Paul. You look very sharp.
It covers up the grey. If you have it all grade one at the side, then you can't see the grey so much.
Okay, this is the final one. Carl Coe, we've got Alex asking about basically these guys do sort of like precision parts that go into things like medical stuff and Carco. Yeah, it used to be a big favourite of Richard Crowe, I think, Cotney Rebel, some time ago when the bowl hit and it zoomed up. Anyway, the shares have come down, they've halved actually over the last nearly year.
I don't know what Richard's current view on this is. I mean, we've been amber on it. We were amber red about a year ago, warning people of the higher risk. But then they did sort out their balance sheet. It does have, it's got various issues. For example, the pension scheme is a huge cash drain. And the broker forecasts say that it's going to become highly cash generative. But I think I need them to show me that rather than it just being in a forecast. You just need to be aware of the bull and bear points, I think, overall on it. It doesn't quite tick my boxes overall, but given that it's got a bit frothy, a bit of a crowded trade, it's come down a lot. Could be worth a fresh look, I'd say. I like charts like that.
Yeah,
because it means a lot of people have capitulated, and it might be, maybe we wait for another bowl, wait for it to stabilize for a few months, and then Richard to start getting excited about it again and nip in and buy a few. So I would say I'm probably pretty neutral overall on Carco. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we'd better call it for a day. I know you've had a really long day there, Paul, because you did an interview with Lord Lee just beforehand, and then you've had an hour and 25 with me. So thanks very much for all your comments.
It's always very stimulating, Paul. I love doing these.
Thanks, everyone, for your questions. And hopefully we'll have another sort of rip-roaring market next week, and we'll have a takeover a day and lots of good news. But I'm with Paul, actually. I actually think next 12 months we're going to reach an inflection point for small and mid-caps with a lot of money coming in. And just as this wave of overseas M&A tells anybody who's rational that there's great value for quality business in the UK.
Yeah, it's just sitting on a plate there, isn't it? It's crazy. Yeah. So in a good way.
All right. Thanks a lot then, guys. See you next week. Thanks, same channel.
Yeah, bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.